To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people.
Because history has shown us that courage can be contagious, and hope can take on a life of its own.
I will bring you hope, and I ask only one thing in return.
We move now, together.
Not at all. Hope is not lost today. It is found.
Hope is what keeps you going.
Even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye, and say no. You move.
Welcome to Reading Rangers Shorts.
Nebula-nominated short stories.
I'm Trish.
I'm Elizabeth.
And I'm Brandon.
Reading Rangers Shorts is our brand new subcast of Reading Rangers, in which we talk about short stories. Yay!
Yay!
This was an area that you, our listeners, asked that we focus more on in our annual survey, so that's what we're trying to do now. We hope you're happy. Today on the show, as Brandon said, we are discussing the Nebula-nominated short stories for this year. And so we're going to start off with short descriptions and reactions, and then we'll move on to a more detailed discussion. But be aware, please, listeners, that we are going to be giving away details about the stories in our discussions. So if you haven't read them yet, we'd encourage you to go to the Nebula's website and check out the stories yourself and then listen. Or if you want to listen to our discussion and see which stories interest you to go follow up on, that's okay too. So, Elizabeth, can you start us off with the first nominated story? I think it's alphabetical.
Yep, alphabetical by surname. We've got The Last Novelist or A Dead Lizard in the Yard by Matthew Kressel, and it was published on Tor.com.
Okay, and so that story was about an author in a mostly virtual and online universe who goes to a planet to write a story by hand, as is his habit, because he likes doing it that way, and what happens to him on the planet where he's trying to write his story. So I liked the story more by the ending than the beginning. By the beginning, here's another story about a writer writing about the writing process, which, of course, is interesting to all writers, but maybe gets a little overused as a trope of stories about authors. But there were some parts of it that I really enjoyed.
I think I felt mostly the same way. It felt not. It wasn't only that it is kind of overplayed that we are accustomed to writing and telling stories about the writing and telling process. But it also felt very slow. It felt like not a lot of other things were happening for a good portion of the beginning of the story. That it was just lots of description and lots of other story within a storytelling before we actually start caring about anybody. That's just me, at least.
I think the slow pace could be intentional, though, because it does make some comment about, a sideways kind of comment about social media and being connected all the time. So the slow pace could be intentional.
I suspect that it was. I'm just not sure how I felt about it.
It did take a little while to warm up, definitely.
Okay, we can come back to that, but meanwhile, Elizabeth, tell us about the next story on the list.
We've got Fandom for Robots, and it's by Veena Jimin Prasad, and it was published in Uncanny.
So I think, Brandon, you wanted to talk about this one first?
Oh, yes, because I really like this one. Fandom for Robots is about a robot named Computron who has suddenly discovered the love of anime out of nowhere and has started like gravitating towards its fandom community and writing fanfiction for this anime because they want to elevate the level of description of robots in other people's fanfiction. It's just a very cute story and I love it so much.
I really enjoyed this one too, actually. I liked that Computron's robotness was something that the fandom valued rather than kind of being pushed back at, which was nice.
I mean, I liked it because I felt like that was thematic and like deliberate in the story, that it is the most extreme example of the kinds of things that I've seen people gravitate towards fandom for, and that is the ability to feel like they're part of a community and being genuinely represented in the forms of media that they enjoy. It felt like I was Computron in that story, if that makes sense. I just really appreciated it from that perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, too, it also does a good job of projecting loneliness, because Computron as a robot frequently reminds people that he has no emotion circuits. So he can't really feel loneliness, but at the same time, the story does a really good job of invoking loneliness and showing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I adored this story. I suppose some people it might say that it doesn't advance the genre much, but it just gave me such a warm, happy feeling reading about Computron, you know, learning about things and connecting with Bjorn Ruffian in their collaborative fan fiction. And, you know, it gave me this happy feeling that maybe the community love for this show could help the museum be sustainable. The Museum of Old Clunky Robots, which was named after Cymac, which was nice. But, I just like a story that is a nice, happy story once in a while. Okay, and Elizabeth, what's next on the list?
We have Welcome to Your Authentic Indian Experience, TM, by Rebecca Roanhorse.
Right, and I think that was in Apex magazine, right?
Yes.
That was about a Native American who, although it never uses that phrase in the story, I don't think, who acts as a kind of virtual tour guide of this authentic Indian experience virtual reality. And he meets a tourist, and the tourist ends up taking over his life. And it made me uncomfortable in all sorts of ways, and I was pretty creeped out by the end. But it was well done!
I mean, that was obviously the goal.
Right.
I have so many thoughts about this story. Obviously, its goal, its objective, is to kind of paint a kind of extreme image of the kinds of appropriation that Native American people obviously always go through in their personal lives, in a way that should obviously make you feel uncomfortable in that extreme image, and then have you come out of that experience of reading the story and ask yourself, well, how have I perhaps done this in real life to people who are alive? Which it did a lot of things for me in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Its use of second person was a really good idea, because it means that you really get the experience of having your life taken over by someone else, it really effectively projected that.
I actually felt, very interestingly enough, like that second person decision made it another layer of creepy to me, because it felt then at the beginning of the story like maybe you're also doing this thing that you actively acknowledge is weird and unsettling.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that, you know, toward the beginning of the story, the the protagonist says, you know, it seems to be kind and looking at all sides, and it says the tourists aren't all bad, they're just needy. But then toward the end, that seems to be maybe not so much the case. But then by the end, you're not really sure what's been happening all along anymore anyway.
Everything just kind of collides at some point, and it feels like you have suddenly found yourself in a thriller without knowing that you were in a thriller in the beginning.
Right, right. And it's another whole layer of what's going on here in this story. So I certainly thought it was an interesting story, even though it made me uncomfortable.
I thought it was an interesting story because it made me uncomfortable.
Fair point, fair.
It definitely deals with its themes well. And I quite liked its use of description as well. It particularly taps into smell, which I thought was great.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so next story, Elizabeth?
Okay, we have Utopia LOL from Jamie Walls, and that was published by Strange Horizons.
So this was a very different kind of tour guide story. We have an almost insanely cheerful but not very helpful tour guide to this person who's been awakened from cryogenic sleep into a very strange new future, which is mostly virtual again. And the tour guide tries very poorly to explain what's going on and then drops the new person into some situations from being a sort of Flappy Bird to being in a Tolkien-esque fantasy to other things. And then it turns out that this has just been a way for the artificial intelligence that's running the whole show for it to manipulate the new person into being an interstellar explorer for them. And parts of it were annoying and parts of it were funny. And again, it was an interesting story, I thought.
I thought it was quite poignant in the end, actually, that even though Kit, our protagonist, is quite flighty, it kind of got quite serious at the end.
I feel the same way, but I wasn't... While I did find the story generally funny, I'm not sure how I feel about how those two parts perfectly intersected. Of course, I must give full disclosure that I had only, like, just very recently actually sat down and read it. But, like, it felt a little bit like... I don't know how to explain it. Like, it just kind of springs on you, this sudden importance at the end of the story after watching several scenes of very weird things happen for fun, which were, I mean, very delightful to see. And one of the things that struck me about this story is it makes a lot of very deliberate choices about its form. For instance, Allocator whenever he appears, he often appears in blocks of text that are formatted differently from the rest of the document. And I think that's an interesting way of kind of letting us into how they're communicating in some of these circumstances. But it feels like a lot of silly things are happening that are genuinely very funny, only for somebody to be proven as the victim of manipulation at the end without really kind of settling on that's a very inappropriate thing to do.
Yeah, it doesn't come down hard on the manipulation aspect.
Well, I mean, it's obvious by the end that it has been manipulation, and it's somewhat reassuring that the AI explains very clearly that it has to have actual consent for a certain course of action. It can't use inferred consent. I was okay with the new person, Charlie, to allow himself to be manipulated into becoming an interstellar explorer. I was less sure that it worked for Kit, the bouncy tour guide, because she has shown herself to be so distractible, and the thought of her signing up for years of isolation and separation from the Allocator, I would have thought she would have been more scared and more reluctant than to just suddenly feel a twinge of loneliness and emulation when Charlie signs up for that duty. So I'm not sure I was quite sold on that decision at the end, but I did like, it certainly made sense that Charlie, the new guy, would have signed up to get away from all this.
I mean, I should add that it is genuinely a very funny story, though.
It is, and one I think that digs into how our experiences and our environment might shape us, like through the way that the characters are manipulated is through like the virtual realities that they're put into, and that kind of shapes. Because, for example, Kit at the beginning is shown as quite flighty and has difficulty concentrating for even short periods of time. But when she comes out of there's like a detective mystery universe that she's been living in for a while, and she's taking the role of the detective. She's obviously kind of been shaped into that role and is quite different, made quite different by it. And that kind of kicks in. There's still lingering remnants of that at the end.
Okay, so let's move on to the next story for the moment.
Clearly Lettered in a Mostly Steady Hand by Fran Wilde, published by Uncanny.
I really, really feel strongly about this story. It's presented in a very stylistic, very richly described way as the description of various rooms in what seems to be a museum of some sort that kind of has on display these kind of macabre images of things that don't seem connected, but as you continue going through the rooms, you not only realize that the descriptions of states that have othered human beings, things that have made people feel like they were being observed, but that the act of passing through that museum renders you observed by the museum as well, and it compels you to do all of these things that you wouldn't typically have even considered until you emerge from that experience knowing, like, understanding a little bit more exactly how unsettling it is to be in a space that makes you feel othered like that, makes you feel observed, watched, makes you feel like an oddity compared to other people. And I have so many feelings about this story that are kind of difficult to describe. It struck me kind of obviously when I read it as a conversation about disability, about how certain groups of people see disabled people, that on the one hand, the medical industry does perhaps not the best job of genuinely being concerned for disabled persons and the way that the kind of help that they need in order to continue, like, operating in society. But on the other hand, the person being let into this space felt like me. It felt like an ordinary, not particularly compelled, able-bodied person being held to account for the ways that he doesn't actually think about other people, in general, at least. And kind of asking able-bodied persons to genuinely think about the way that they actually look at people, the way that they interact with people, the way that they move, the way that they act in public, which was really striking for me, because it's the kind of experience even I haven't genuinely had to, like, kind of engender that kind of empathy, and I appreciated the story in that regard.
For me, I mean, the story engendered, I felt threatened while I was reading it, like the museum was subtly threatening me as I was going through its tour, and I felt guilty and horrified. And toward the end, I wasn't quite sure whether the tourist was going to be allowed to leave the museum or not. It seemed like they had been sort of transformed into a vaguely insectile creature crawling through the museum, and I think that kind of speaks to the transformative experience of fiction and empathy, trying to put yourself in someone's place, if you really succeed in empathizing, that it's going to change you. So I thought it did well in that respect.
Oh, it's a very beautiful story as well. The language was absolutely gorgeous.
Yes, it was. In ways that I think that it's fair to say that that while it's a beautiful story and people should be able to read it purely on the quality of its language, I do feel at times that it may be so strong that at there are times when you need to read very, very carefully in order to understand exactly what's happening as we continue going forward. But I do think that that's deliberate, and I think that that kind of slower reading, encouraging that kind of slower reading from this story, actually makes you feel more sucked in. It gets you to the point where it feels less like you're hearing this happen to somebody else, even though they're speaking to you, but that you are actually here and you are actually feeling yourself being shifted in this way, which I appreciated.
It does tie in really well thematically with the story as well. There's a part where it talks about the light is fit like a bit low, so if you want to see the detail, you have to get up close. And I think that the style that it's written in kind of mimics that.
I do feel like that is the case, and I feel like it's told less like a story and more like something that you wouldn't read. It feels like you're, as I said, being led on a guided tour of a museum.
An experience.
Yeah, and when those moments happen as a result, it feels kind of like you're being asked to stop for a moment at every paragraph and observe something or answer a question. And I felt compelled at that moment, actually, to think about the way that I feel at every moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of real subtle points being made through the writing. And so it's definitely a story that rewards your closest attention and rereading.
It definitely does.
Okay. And Elizabeth, I think we're down to the last story.
We sure are. We've got Carnival 9 by Carol M. Joachim, and it was published by Beneath Ceaseless Skies.
Carnival 9 is quite a beautiful story about a person named Z, who is a part of a community of what seems to be like dolls that have to be wound every day in order to be awake and operate in the world. And she's dealing with what those turns of the key in her back mean as a kind of way that they live, what that means about life and what that means about death, while also meeting someone cute at a carnival nearby and bonding with them and seeing how that shapes the way that all of them think about the way that they live.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that they all knew at the start of their day how many winds of the clock that they had so that they could kind of estimate how much they could accomplish in a day. So that was interesting for, you know, how you get to plan your day like that and how, you know, once you're done, there's nothing you can do to get more energy for the day. And I also really thought the themes of responsibility to others were explored through the story. There's Zoe, you know, bailing on her father to go to the carnival early in the story, and then as she moves through her life, she's mostly responsible for other people, including her child later, but every once in a while she gets the urge to just take another day for herself, and you know, that is perfectly understandable, but it doesn't always go well for her or for the people around her. And so I thought it was interesting how that was explored. And I just liked that little world that she was moving through, the town and the carnival and back to the town, back to the carnival, her trading favors with other people. There were just so many intricate little pieces of this world. I love the world building in it, and I loved watching Zoe go through her life like that.
I thought it was a really good way of expressing spoon theory, if you are familiar with that. To see that kind of embodied in a story was really quite something. I liked that it also, it's tapping in not just to kind of disability and like chronic illness, but also the experience of carers as well, so that it manages to kind of give weight to both of those things in a way that was compassionate, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The story spends a lot of time that I really appreciated speaking about how this one element of world building that is how many turns each person has, taking that and expanding it into how much more valuable it becomes to be able to like care for others and have a responsibility to make the best out of the little time that you have, because you may still have more than other people. Like, for instance, in the beginning of the story, there's a lot of concern about Z's grandparents. And it felt like that rule that they had established about those turns, about that key, turned into a general kind of shape of the world about how important it is for you to help other people when it's harder for them to be able to navigate in space because of the gears that they have, because of how many turns they may have. And I think that's a very comforting kind of way to think about the world building rule that would have otherwise not engendered that kind of understanding in another story. And it was part of the reason that I kept reading that, because I wanted to see more and more how that helped people continue being the kinds of people that they were.
Yeah. Along that vein, I thought it was interesting how Zoe and Vale planned their child so carefully. They were, you know, looking over the parts that would make up their child, and making some compromises along the way with each other about what kind of child they would have. And then the child turned out to have a weak mainspring. And then Vale really couldn't deal with that, and so Zoe had to basically take the burden all on herself for at least a while. And I just thought, oh, that gave me a lot of feelings, you know. You can't plan for what's going to happen in life, and, you know, sometimes you just have to shoulder burdens. I thought it was really beautifully expressed.
In part because we're kind of watching a world where people still kind of have a little bit more say in those kinds of roll of the dice universe things than we do. Because I wish I were in a position to wonder whether my child would have pincers. But even when you attempt to maintain a certain kind of control over making sure that the people you love will continue being alive and not suffer in the world, sometimes there's something that you miss, sometimes there's something that you have no control over. And it hurts more in this story because you see them try to have that kind of control and they don't.
Matt and the son, I feel like they're always careful not to take his agency away, being that he has a weak mainspring and he doesn't have many turns or much energy, I suppose, in translation. Z does her best to make sure that he can do the things that he wants to do. But also, the story, I think, respects or shows that Matin makes very particular choices about the way he spends his turns. And I liked that too.
Yeah. And of course, I also liked how adept Zoe got at reading what Matin was doing with, you know, just little tightening of his finger, meaning that he assented to something or that he was excited about something. You know, it was kind of a strain feeling for her, you know, having to be so alert and attentive and careful all the time. But you also had to love her for doing that.
Well, I mean, that kind of parental experience is something that's not foreign in the real world. It's just, and when you see it, even if you've never been in a family or been in a relationship with somebody in some way who's experiencing that same kind of thing, you still know what that looks like and you still know how that feels. And using that kind of shorthand of the way that people are designed, essentially, to illustrate that is a very simple but incredibly empathetic way of phrasing it.
Yeah, it was a beautifully written story. Looking at the Nebula nominees as a whole, one thing that struck me was that half of them have manipulation as a fairly key factor. The Welcome to Your Authentic Indian Experience, obviously, Utopia Lal, and Clearly Lettered in a Mostly Steady Hand, those all had manipulation as important elements in the stories.
Mm. I hesitate to call all of them manipulation, although it's true that manipulation is essentially at the core of them all. I guess it's a matter of, in some of those instances, it felt a lot instead like, I struggle to find a way to genuinely describe it. But it's almost as if there is an experience in some of those instances that people don't know well enough that they need to have. And I think that it's true enough for the characters in those stories. In particular, I'm thinking of Clearly Lettered in a Mostly Steady Hand and Welcome to Your Authentic Indian Experience. It's honest to say that that's true of the reader when you get into the story as well. That when you come into it, you have no idea what you're getting into, and then you suddenly find yourself experiencing something more deeper and more disturbing as a result. That experience of getting more than you bargained for, while kind of relies on a kind of manipulation, is nobler to me than just plain manipulation trademark. But that's having the hindsight of actually having read them and actually gained that kind of value.
I think maybe like the distinction that you're trying to make also taps into who has the power in it. So, for example, Clearly Lettered in a Mostly Steady Hand, it's not about the majority having power and manipulating a minority. It's about the minority taking back their power, which is different to, say, Utopia, LOL, which is where the AI clearly has all the power, and even though it's bound by very particular rules, it's still got the power there, and so the manipulation is a bit different.
Yeah, that's part of where that feeling about the manipulation comes from. But it's also because the reclamation of that power by the minorities in those stories is for the purposes of not necessarily education so much as empathy. That they're asking you to be in this space because they want you to discover something about that world that is important for you going forward in the real world. And I think that the information that you get as a result, the experience that you get as a result, is genuinely important, which I didn't particularly get from Utopia LOL.
It's a very good point.
Mm-hmm. Did any themes among the stories particularly strike either of you two other than that?
I personally felt like a lot of it also had to deal with identity in an obviously political way. I mean, identity is at the core of every character identification in any story in general. But Fandom for Robots, Welcome to Your Authentic Indian Experience, and Clearly Lettered in a Mostly Steady Hand are deliberately about reframing social issues pertaining to identity in ways that become more palatable to people who have never genuinely encountered those conversations or try not to experience those conversations. So they find themselves going, oh yes, I understand this feeling. This feeling is a fair one to have. This is a reasonable way to establish how that feels to other people. And then you come out of it going, but this is about somebody. This is what somebody is going through. Carnival Nine has that in spades as well. This kind of illustrating a kind of experience that people, that certain groups of people, certain minority groups of people know well and experience often enough, but put in a way that it's not obvious. It's not always necessarily obvious exactly what's being described until you get to that point where it hits you over the head and you go, ah, I know who this is about. And I should now, like, ask questions about what that means about me and how I interact with those people, or how people interact with me.
Okay. And Elizabeth, did you have any other, did anything else strike you?
Actually, there was one thing that kind of tapped into what Brandon was saying. And that was in relation to the last author and identity. Because in that particular case, you have this old man is the last author, and he meets a young girl native to the planet and kind of mentors her into taking over his role, I guess, as the last author. And so I thought that was quite an interesting comment, in a way kind of tapping into what's going on in the writing field generally at the moment. Does that make sense?
I think that makes a lot of sense.
So I feel like that kind of ties into that theme of identity in a way.
Yeah. I feel compelled to respond to one thing that was said very, very early about whether something furthers the field of science fiction and fantasy or not. I feel like what is most obvious about these nominees, and is arguably a trend in science fiction and fantasy awards for the past few years, is a really intense observation of the value of social science fiction, and in general, how you can use speculative fiction as a lens through which you reobserve things that are taking place right now in our own personal lives that we had not previously paid any attention to or cared about. I think that those things are valuable. I think that when you express those things in interesting and challenging ways, people latch onto them because as a result they become very well-told, very interesting stories that aren't trying to beat you over the head with something. And I think that all of these stories, or most of these stories, accomplish that very well. They're on their surface, if that's a nice thing to say, just very well written, very interesting stories about worlds that are more or less just like ours, just one or two things have changed about how those worlds work. And I think that when you do simple things like that with a very good attention to language and character, as all of these stories have, you end up telling a story that other people can just like when they read it, and then suddenly discover something about it as they apply the things that they've seen or discovered from those stories into the real world. So to me, they kind of naturally further, I mean, I shudder to say further, because I don't think that this isn't a thing that has been happening in the genre for quite some time. But for the people who think that it hasn't been, I think that it should happen more often.
Mm-hmm. Right. I wasn't necessarily agreeing with the viewpoint that one should attempt to further the field in whatever story one writes, but it is an attitude that one encounters in criticism. So I was actually pushing back a little bit against that in my unabashed adoration of what seems to be a fairly simple story in Fandom for Robots.
I know that that wasn't your intention, but for the people who may hear you say that and respond silently to themselves with snark, I decided I'd just throw that in there.
Well, thank you. Okay, well, I suppose it would be nice if everyone listening to this has already listened to all the stories or will listen to all the stories, but do you want to go around and say, if you read just one story, read this one, or not?
I should have to say so because I think that you should read all of them.
I'm fine with that, if that's our vote.
Although I would like to just notice that we mentioned the poetry in Clearly Lettered in a Mostly Steady Hand. I believe Uncanny did a podcast with that story read by Amal El-Motar. So I think that would be really worth giving a listen to.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's also one of the Escape Artists family did a podcast of Carnival 9 as well, and that is worth checking out too. We can put links in the show notes to all of these stories.
I do think in that vein, I think that it's fair to say that there are some of these stories that sound, that you experience better when you hear them than when you read them. And I do think that clearly Lettered in a Mostly Steady Hand is an example of something that you should definitely experience by listening to the podcast before you decide to read it. But in that vein, I do think that Utopia LOL is something that you should read. I know that I'm pretty sure it would have, that Strange Horizons would have made a podcast version of it. But if you had to choose, like if in the middle of the morning when you decide whether you want to listen to it on the way to work, or just wait until you get back home to read it, wait until you get back home and read the text. You will enjoy it much more, I think, that way.
Yeah, part of the story of Utopia LOL is told in old-fashioned emoticons where, you know, you don't have an image, you have less than sign, colon, left parenthesis.
How our ancestors used to do it.
And so, you know, it's valuable to encounter it in that way. But I will say also that for Clearly Lettered in a Mostly Steady Hand, that listening to it in a podcast does force you to slow down and take the language as it comes rather than skimming quickly through the entries. And that forces you to slow down and appreciate the language and the subtleties.
I'd also suggest that maybe Fandom for Robots is a good one to read as well, because it does involve chat logs and things, and I think that's probably a form that would display best in text as opposed to in audio.
I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really cool that we have these options.
Yes. So by the time this comes out, probably the Hugo short stories will have been nominated, so it'll be very interesting to compare the lists and see what, if any, of these stories made it onto that list and what other offerings come up that we should, you know, be aware of and catch up on.
I genuinely suspect that a great deal of these nominees will share the Hugo list as well.
I kind of hope so, because that means that we will have a leg up on our Hugo reading, if that's the case.
Right, and if not, we may have lots more to talk about. But I think that's going to be about it for our discussion today. So thank you to all of our listeners, and thank to Brandon for being here, and thanks to Elizabeth.
And thank you to you, Trish.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Okay, all right. Well, happy reading, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to support us, you can find us at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so at our email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, and on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro and outro music comes from Dimension by Creo. You can find out more about them at freemusicarchive.org.